Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we talk with a health expert who's also a lusty eater. He is Dr. Andrew Weil, creator of what he calls integrative medicine. His latest book is The Healthy Kitchen, Recipes for a Better Body, Life, and Spirit. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson talks icy cool wine cocktails. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby introduces us to the vegetables from Latin America. We get the scoop on what's literally hot in soda. It's hot chilies, guys. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things going with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we've been in Salina, Utah, and we found a great place to eat scones, which are a Utah specialty, and chicken fried steak, which is a cowboy specialty.
Scones, a specialty of Utah? Never thought of that.
Well, in fact, the scones at Mom's and throughout Utah are completely different from the English ancestored scones that we think of when we think of scones. These scones are more like sopapillas or Indian fry bread. It's a circle of dough that is quickly deep fried, and then it is served generally with honey on the side. It's a side dish to accompany breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Oh, it sounds incredible. So tell me about this place, Mom's.
Well, I have to tell you about Salina, Utah. It's one of these great, dusty, old Western towns that's got one main street and always seems to have a haze of sand blowing through it or tumbleweeds. If towns had room tone, this would just have that, like a wonderful kind of non-existent ambiance. It's so quiet, you can hear people across the street talking. Mom's is the only place to eat in town, and the people who come there are locals. You'll see a lot of cowboy hats. You see a lot of dusty old Wranglers and work-hardened, calloused hands. Cowboys come at lunch to eat chicken fried steak. And within Mom's, it's also very quiet. And the only thing that I remember hearing is the waitress's rubber-soled orthopedic waitress shoes, you know, those big white nurse-like shoes that waitresses wear, sort of squeaking around on the linoleum. But in true Western fashion, there was not a lot of talking, not a lot of chatter, and no music.
So the people are just eating.
People are just eating. And one of the interesting things that we saw at Mom's, well, the last time we were there, we've been going to this place literally for 25 years now. It's been there since the 1940s, so it's been around. Mm-hmm. But the last time we were there, there were several tourists from Germany at one table. They spoke very little English, and the waitress was trying with some difficulty to explain to them over easy, hash browns. Mm-hmm. They weren't quite getting it. Finally, they managed to order what they ordered, and you could see their eyes just light up with glee when their breakfast, which was chicken fried steak, arrived, because this was something they recognized. It was just like Wiener Schnitzel, only made with beef.
So chicken fried steak is where you pound a steak or a piece of beef with flour, right? I mean, you beat the thing into submission.
And that's exactly right. And it is our contention, although we have no historical data to back this up, that chicken fried steak was, in fact, invented by immigrants from Germany or perhaps Austria or Czechoslovakia who had no fine veal to work with. So they got these tough old ornery pieces of cow and beat them into submission. As you said, the traditional way to do it is with one of those old-fashioned, very thick Coca-Cola bottles. You beat the heck out of the steak, you bread it, and then you deep fry it and then make pan gravy out of the drippings.
Oh, so they do a good one, I gather.
Oh, they do a great chicken fried steak. And, of course, on the side, you get eggs, you get toast, you get hash browns, and you get about 14 cups of coffee.
And if you're a nonstop compulsive shopper like me, you will also probably walk away with something that has nothing to do with the restaurant. When Michael and I were there the last time, there was a Paiute Indian sitting at the next booth who was wearing this beautiful porcupine quill hat band on his cowboy hat. And I went to his booth and sat down, and we had a little discussion, and a few dollars changed hands, and I walked away with the porcupine quill hat band for my hat.
So if you meet Jane Stern, she'll buy the clothes off your back.
Exactly.
Jane, thank you. Michael,
you're
thank
welcome.
You.
Adios.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, I'm not going on down to Ma and Pa's Cafe. Mercy. I want some taters and gravy with some chicken fried steak. I want some taters and gravy, chicken fried steak. Little mama don't make me wait. I get hungry, I'm a mighty main man. Set up mama, fast as you can. Whoa, son, yeah, let's rock.
Well, Jane and Michael Stern's newest book is the update of their great classic, Road Food. You can hear them here every week, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Wine expert Joshua Wesson is a classically trained sommelier who developed his own personal take. He believes good wine can be had for little money, and wine can be an everyday beverage, like beer. Josh, good to have you back.
Oh, it's so nice to be back. I can't even tell you.
Josh, what's your take on wine cocktails? Do you think they're an abomination?
Yes, it's biblical and it's abomination. I love wine cocktails, and it being, you know, warm in New York, and it's probably warm all over the country right now. There's nothing wrong with sticking an ice cube or two into some wine and maybe adding a couple of other little things to make that wine taste more delicious, more refreshing. There's no reason to avoid wine cocktails. I say, why not?
Okay. Well, all right. Now, the next question, of course, is what are your favorites?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of wine cocktails that people perhaps never considered as cocktails. They were just drinks that they would order. You know, you go to France, you have a Kir. If you're anywhere near Dijon, where they drop a little bit of cassis into some eligoté or dry white wine. And if you want to be fancy, you can stick a couple of those drops into sparkling wine or champagne and have a Kir Royale. That's a wine cocktail, but people probably don't think of it as a cocktail, maybe as an aperitif or something fancy.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Spain and you see people drinking all different kinds of wines on the rocks. I've seen sherry sometimes on the rocks, and in Portugal, they are absolutely crazy for white port on the rocks with a slice of citrus. And, the old song, white port lemon juice, people think it's coming out of a bag, but it's really not. It's really a wonderful thing. And I was really intrigued because the other day I had a dry white port and I put some over ice, and instead of putting a slice of citrus, I took some crushed mint. And it was fantastic. I never would have guessed that it was port that was in there. And I added a little spritz of soda, and I kicked back, and it was 10 in the morning, so it really put a cant on the day.
I can see. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like a Portuguese take on what do they call it, a mojito from Latin America, where it's rum and mint and something's, you know, fizzy. It sounds like it's similar to that.
It does, you know, but the difference, of course, in a mojito, they add rum, and rum will get your clothes off more quickly than anything else I've ever tasted. That doesn't happen when you're drinking white port on the rocks. So keep your clothes on cocktail. This is it. Wonderful, easy to make, and delicious. And if you like it a little bit sweeter, then get a sweet white port, and you'll be set. But there are other cocktails, too. Bellini's, of course, classic. You don't have to go to Harry's Bar in Venice to have one. Peach nectar and a little bit of Prosecco. Sangrias. White or red are delicious ways to turn wine into something festive and delicious and more than just wine. And, of course, you can make sangria out of a whole heap of different wines, but never spend more than $5 or $6 on the base wine and never get anything that's too old. You asked me before when we were off the air, what are some absolute no-nos? You know, don't even think about going there. Don't use any wine that's ever seen wood when you're making wine cocktails, because when you chill down wines that have wood, the bitterness comes out, and that's a bad thing for the cocktail.
Ah, so that would leave out things like oaky Chardonnays, right? And red wines that have been aged in wood, maybe like Zinfandels or Cabernet Sauvignon?
well, some Zinfandels aren't aged in wood, and if they're fruity, they're fine. But if they are aged in wood, or Cabernets, or Merlots, you were talking about, you know, biblical abominations.
Yeah.
You know, thunderbolts coming down from on high when you start using wooded wines in wine cocktails. That's about the only no-no. Don't spend a lot of money. Don't use anything with wood. Make sure it's fresh and young and inexpensive. And basically, you know, the wine's fungible. But there are two wines I want to mention that I keep in my fridge because they're great. If you just pour them over rocks with a little bit of a twist or just a little splash of soda, and they're fruity and they're floral and they're fragrant. They have beautiful acidity, so they're very refreshing, and they have a hint of sweetness. And the two wines that I keep in my fridge for just such an eventuality as people drop again and I don't have anything else to serve, Hoag Late Harvest Riesling, which sounds like a dessert wine, but it's actually just off dry.
Mm-hmm.
And it only sells for, you know, $9-$10. And Quadi Electra, which is this unfortified, no brandy having been added to, this muscat. And it's made from an orange muscat. It's a variety of muscat that's particularly fragrant. And you stick either one of those on the rocks with a slice of orange or a slice of lime or lemon, and you're going to have an insanely good drink.
Sounds great. Okay, so think cheap, think Electra, right?
Morning and, becomes and Electra.
Yes, exactly. Greek tragedy.
Like Saturday.
And no wood.
No wood, except for the stick that you stir.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is the mind behind Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find his wine cocktail recommendations on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, two cocktails Josh didn't mention that I love at this time of year are Martini and Rossi, white vermouth on the rocks. And by the way, in Europe, if you order a martini, this is what you're going to get. It's kind of sweet and kind of herbal, and it's really delicious. And then the other drink is called Pim's Cup. It's a British specialty. You buy it in the liquor store. It's sort of pre-blended, and it's fruit juices and alcohol. It's a secret formula, so you just look for Pim's Cup. There are different numbers. I like number one, and you follow the recipe on the bottle. And it's usually something like ginger ale and Pim's over ice with wedges of orange and sticks of cucumber. These are so delicious. Okay, coming up, simple changes guaranteed to make you healthier from Dr. Andrew Weil. I guarantee there are no wine cocktails in this. And new Latin vegetables and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. Dr. Andrew Weil is an MD who took a different path than most of his colleagues, one that some call controversial. When he graduated from Harvard Medical School, he became one of a growing number of physicians who embrace not only conventional medicine, but old ways with herbal healing, using the body and the mind for wellness, and using food as a healer. He calls this integrative medicine. He's written 8 books. His latest cookbook, co-authored with cook Rosie Daly, she of the Oprah Winfrey's cook fame. The book is called The Healthy Kitchen. Dr. Weil, welcome.
Thank you.
So what's your advice to people who really love food and need some just simple things that they can do to change the way they eat and to be healthier?
Well, I think the first is holding on to the idea, which I believe in very firmly, that eating in a healthy way does not in any way mean giving up what you like or giving up the pleasure of eating. I think it's possible to get as much or more pleasure out of eating in a healthy way than it is eating in an unhealthy way. And I think that the real culprits in the American diet today are refined and processed foods. I think the fewer of them we eat, the better off we are. The more we eat foods in the way nature gives them to us, the better. So that would be my main piece of advice. Really learn to read labels, to know how to interpret them, try to eat fewer of the products of modern food technology.
Okay, let's get to specifics. Do you have sort of your top three on your hit list of foods?
I certainly do. I would say, you know, first, if you look at fats, which I think are key influences on health, I think partially hydrogenated oils, which are ubiquitous in snack foods, in commercial baked goods, all the cookies, crackers, chips, pretzels, all of these things, they all have partially hydrogenated oils. These are deadly. They promote cancer, they promote inflammation, they accelerate aging. You want to get them out of your diet, out of your pantry. And by doing that, at one stroke, you eliminate whole categories of foods which are unhealthy for other reasons as well. So I would say that would be my number one.
Isn't that also the vegetable oils and stuff we usually find in the supermarket, the corn oil and the safflower oil and all that other business?
Those are not partially hydrogenated. Those are liquid vegetable oils. However, I don't think those are so great either. They're not so good for us on other accounts. I think, you know, we should be eating olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, and the other healthy monounsaturated fats, the fats that are in avocados and nuts, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Grapeseed oil is a good choice of a cooking oil. But these partially hydrogenated oils, these are artificially hardened fats. They're, as I say, ubiquitous in commercial products, and they're really not good for us.
Okay, your number two food.
Well, I would say the things with artificial colors and artificial sweeteners, that these are categories of chemicals that are very suspect. They're suspect of causing cancer, of damaging the nervous system, and there's no reason for them to be in food in the first place. So, you know, you wouldn't put them in if you're making food at home, and you shouldn't be eating foods that have them in at all.
Well, what about good things? Simple something that we can do.
All right, I've already mentioned the good oils, olive oil especially. I think eating fish is a good idea for most people, that especially if you can substitute fish for some of the meat now in the American diet. I'm a big fan of soybeans and other beans. I think eating moderate amounts of whole soy foods on a regular basis is extremely health protective. And I suppose the most solid and consistent message coming from nutritional research is that fruits and vegetables contain a host of health protective compounds. We keep discovering new ones. So finding ways to get more fruits and vegetables of good quality into the diet, I think, is key. For many Americans, vegetables mean ketchup, iceberg lettuce, and French fried potatoes. That doesn't do it.
Okay. Bring in the green beans and the broccoli, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And berries, which are terrific, by the way. You know, berries are wonderful foods. They've got very strong antioxidant activity in their pigments. The little seeds have lots of fiber that's good for us. They're good all around.
What's your take on caffeine?
I am a lover of tea. I think the research on the health benefits of tea is very impressive. Tea contains significantly less caffeine than coffee, and it also seems to be in a form that's less irritating to the body than that in coffee. I'm particularly fond of good quality green tea, which I think is especially healthy. And I drink some of that every day. So I'm not opposed to caffeine. I think many people who use coffee in our culture are addicted to it and will have withdrawal if they stop. And a lot of other people have medical problems that are worsened by coffee, especially things like heart arrhythmias and insomnia and bladder problems and stomach problems and intestinal problems and so forth. If you can use coffee or other forms of caffeine non-addictively and don't have symptoms that are worsened by it, I think it's fine. And as I say, I think the health benefits of tea probably override any of the negative effects of the moderate amounts of caffeine there.
Doctor, we're constantly hearing this term lately, glycemic index. And evidently, this is really important, and I don't think most of us have a clue. Can you explain?
I'm glad you're hearing about it. This is good. The glycemic index is a new scale of rating carbohydrate foods by how fast they are digested and raise levels of blood sugar. The reason this is important is that carbohydrate foods that raise blood sugar quickly force the pancreas to secrete insulin to clear sugar from the blood. And in people who have a certain genetic constitution, which is many of us, eating a lot of these foods eventually leads to insulin resistance and is probably the underlying cause of a great deal of obesity, high blood pressure, and eventually adult onset diabetes in our culture. I think a lot of obesity in America is not driven by fat. It's driven by eating the wrong kinds of carbohydrates. In general, the highly refined and processed carbohydrates are high on the glycemic index, whereas beans, winter squashes, yams, whole grains, cracked grains are low on the glycemic index. But all the things made out of flour, whether it's corn flour, wheat flour, whether it's whole wheat flour, white flour, these are high in the glycemic index. And it's not good to eat a whole lot of those kinds of foods. I think if people have a classic pattern of a tendency to gain weight in the abdomen, high serum triglycerides, low good cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol, adult onset diabetes in the family, these are people who are likely to be carbohydrate sensitive. And that doesn't mean you should not eat carbohydrates, which some people are telling us these days. It means that you should eat lower on the glycemic index scale. If you are going to eat a high glycemic index food like a waffle, you want to cover it with berries, which have a low glycemic index, and that brings the glycemic index of the meal down to the moderate range.
Okay. Last question. Is there a magic pill? Is there one supplement? I know. But is there one thing you would like me to take as a supplement?
Well, you know, I think it's probably not a bad idea for people to take a basic antioxidant formula, which would include vitamin C, vitamin E, a mixed carotenoid formula, and the trace mineral selenium. And I think the health benefits of these are great. It's got to be recognized, though, that these are not substitutes for the foods that contain them. If you take supplements, I think it's okay to think of them as insurance against gaps in the diet, but they are not substitutes for the foods, especially fruits and vegetables, that contain them, which probably have many other beneficial elements as well.
Well, Dr. Weil, thank you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Dr. Andrew Weil is co-author with Rosie Daly of The Healthy Kitchen, Recipes for a Better Body, Life, and Spirit. You can get their recipe for Mexican chicken soup. This is one of those meal-in-a-bowl deals on our website, splendidtable.org. With Dr. Weil talking about the health benefits of olive oil, I think it might be helpful to reiterate my list of bargain oils and tell you about a premium one that I'm enjoying a lot right now. Now, if you want unadulterated healthy oil, it should be extra virgin. Now, this means it's been pressed without heat or solvents, which can affect nutrients. My bargain finds are in the $8 a quart range. Now, my criteria for them is they have to taste distinctive enough that you'd want to put them on a salad and also be cheap enough for cooking. So here are the picks, and they're all extra virgins. Bella, Whole Foods 365 brand, Cost Plus' extra virgin, and Costco's Toscano, which is dated with the year of harvest. Now, this is a real find. And if you want to splurge, there's an extra virgin olive oil with a nice soft fruitiness and kind of spiky pepper that's great for sprinkling over finished dishes. It comes from New Zealand. Yeah, you heard that right. This isn't Tuscany. It's New Zealand. And it's called Mutare Grove, and it's the 2001 press. Now, all the bargain names are on the website under Gourmet Guide, and you can get the New Zealand oil at the Splendid Table store. Just go to splendidtable.org. John Willoughby wears more hats than most food pros. He's executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, an award-winning food writer, and co-author with his pal Chris Slazinger of a clutch of books on grilling. John, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, what have you been working on?
Well, I'm not sure if this counts as working, but I just got back from Costa Rica. And down there, I rediscovered my love affair with yuca.
Yuca, as in
yuca,
a vegetable.
As in a Latin root vegetable. This Latin root vegetables are wonderful. And they are those vegetables that you probably walk by when you're in the supermarket. There's a big bin. There's probably three or four kinds of them. And they basically look like roots of trees or small branches. So they're a little intimidating, and they are not beautiful on the outside, but they are beautiful on the inside. And yuca is my absolute favorite. And it is practically the national dish of Costa Rica. Actually, most of the yuca imported into the United States these days comes from Costa Rica. So it is, it's a wonderful ingredient to cook with. It's fun to explore. It's got lots of great qualities. And it's new for a lot of people, cooking in this country. So it's a great thing.
So is this, it's a root vegetable. It looks like a tree root. What does it taste like?
Well, it tastes, it has a sort of buttery flavor. It's very, very high in starch, much higher in starch than a potato, so high in starch that when you cook it, it practically becomes almost translucent. It is really very starchy. It has a kind of buttery, slightly bland flavor, mm-hmm. which I like very much. And it is often served with very highly spiced sauces like a mojo, which is a sour orange or lime juice with garlic and a little hot pepper sometimes. And it can be used basically any way that a potato can be used. One thing you have to be aware of when you're or know about when you're cooking yuca is if you boil it and then whip it, which is a way that it's often used, it does tend to get a little gluey, which is a quality that some people like and some people don't like. But if you bake it or steam it, it has this wonderful flavor that it's like I would use it like I would use a potato, just for a little variety. And we also discover when we were down in Costa Rica that there are great ways to use this kind of highly starchy quality. A friend of mine, Steve Johnson, who's a chef, was down there with us, and we had cooked some yuca. We had yuca at every meal, and we had also had some leftover snapper. So what he did was he took the snapper and some yuca and made fish cakes. And these were the best fish cakes I've ever had, because the yuca, you only need to use a little bit of it, and it binds the fish together, so it can be mostly fish with just a little yuca. And the two flavors really complement each other. The yuca is like the potato in that it goes with almost anything. But it has, to me, a little more buttery, more substantial flavor than a potato.
I'm thinking about what it would be like if you would cut it in sticks and fry it and then dip it in sour orange juice and garlic and hot chili.
Oh, yeah, yuca fries and yuca chips, just like little fried yuca chips like potato chips are great. They are so, you get them down there everywhere, deep-fried yuca chips. They're wonderful.
Oh, sounds great. Okay,
you're a genius, Lynn.
Well, no, I'm just thinking. Well, you know, this is that old business. If you fry it, it's going to be great. And what you're describing,
right.
The flavor sounds good. So what other vegetables did you find?
Well, there's a lot of other root vegetables down there. One that I really love that is probably less familiar to most cooks here is called the boniato. And it is basically, it's a member of the sweet potato family, and it looks like a sweet potato. It's not as kind of strange looking as yuca. It just looks like a sort of elongated sweet potato, but it's white or white with sort of maroon speckles inside. And you can use it just like a sweet potato, but the way I like it best is to bake it. And it really tastes like a cross between a potato and a chestnut. It has an amazing rich flavor. And if you just bake it and put some butter on it, it is going to be like the best roast sweet potato you ever tasted in your life.
So we can find these things in our markets.
You can. Any Latin market will have both of these and other root vegetables, the yam and the malanga. There's a wide variety of them. But yuca and boniato should be in any Latin market and a lot of Asian markets, too.
Okay, we'll try them. Hey, thanks, Joe.
Yeah. Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and co-author with Chris Lazinger of Let the Flames Begin. You can get their recipe for yuca, corn, and tomato hobo pack, I love the title, on the website splendidtable.org. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Christian on the line. So, Christian, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I've got a very serious problem. My wife and I have been trying to make a cake from scratch.
Right.
And every time we make it, it comes out bready, like cornbread.
Oh.
These cookbooks, they swear that I don't have to use cake flour, but I'm wondering if that's not the case.
Now, when you say like cornbread, do you mean it comes out heavy?
Yeah, it's heavy. And it's kind of got a crust on top, too.
Huh. Okay, two things come to mind. First of all, is there a specific recipe you're using? And if it is, what book is it from?
Well, I tried to use the yellow cake recipe from Fanny Farmer and one from the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook.
Well, those are both pretty well-tested books.
Oh.
Yeah, no, because, you know, there are some, I shouldn't say this, I'm a food writer, but some cookbooks perhaps aren't as well tested as others are, but Better Homes and Gardens, Fanny Farmer, that's pretty thorough testing. Here's some thoughts for you. Number one, almost every oven in the United States is off.
Okay.
I mean, just as a general piece of information. And so if your oven is off, it will not bake properly, and that's where maybe the crust and even the texture may be coming from. So what you do is you go out and you buy a Taylor oven thermometer, the kind that has mercury in it. It's in a glass sort of tube set in a metal frame, and you put that in the middle rack of your oven, and that's how you decide if your oven's off or on or whatever.
Okay.
Because the temperature is vital.
Yeah, okay, I guess that's the trick then. I don't have to sift or use the cake flour?
Now wait, though. There's another step here.
Okay.
Depending on how you measure your flour, 1 cup of flour can weigh 3 ounces or it can weigh 6 ounces. Now, a lot of recipes don't tell you how to measure your flour, but the general rule for cakes is you take the cup, you put it down on the counter, you spoon flour into it. You don't tamp it or tap it. You just level it off, and that's your cup of flour.
Okay.
It sounds like, to me, as though maybe you've got too much flour in that cup. Maybe you're tapping it. Maybe you're dipping it into the flour sack and then leveling it off. All of those produce a different quantity of flour in the cup.
Yeah, I'm doing the latter.
You're dipping it in and leveling it. So try my technique, which will put, really, it's less flour in the cup.
Okay.
So lightly spoon it in.
Uh-huh.
And just level it. And is the recipe telling you to sift the flour?
No, it's not.
Then don't sift it. You don't have to sift it. What I usually do is when I reach into the sack with the spoon, you know, to get it, I kind of fluff the flour a little. And then just spoon it into the cup and level it off with a flat surface, like, you know, the back of a knife or something.
Okay.
Now, try those two things. And then if you are still having a problem, mm-hmm. you call immediately.
Okay.
Do you know, really, this is such a good question, because these are two factors that a lot of us never realize. And you go to make a cake, you know, you say, finally, I'm going to bite the bullet. I'm going to make my own cake. And then you look at it. It's a hockey puck. Take it from a woman who lived with a lot of hockey pucks.
Hey, well, thank you very much for your time.
You are welcome. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week's question was inspired by Josh Wesson's piece on wine cocktails, and he mentioned drinking port on ice. Well, here's the question. What's the relationship between port wine and bad luck? I've got a hint for you. It's a lesson in etiquette. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll be getting back to your calls in a moment, and the number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia query. This week's question is, what's the relationship between port wine and bad luck? Well, it's a piece of very British etiquette. If you pass port wine around the table counterclockwise, it will bring bad luck to everybody there. Now, this comes straight from the proverbial butler's mouth, a book by an English butler. It's called The Butler's Guide to Clothes Care, Managing the Table, Running the Home, and Other Graces by Stanley Ager. So if the person on your right wants some port, you have to pass the bottle all the way around to the left, that's clockwise, until it gets to him. And it would always be a him, according to the butler. Even as recently as the 1980s, in the best English houses, at the end of dinner, the women left the men at the table to drink their port. In fact, proper women didn't drink port at all. The butler says the only exception was a half a glass taken with, and I quote, a dry biscuit at mid-morning. Very sustaining is his observation. Shades of Gosford Park is mine. Okay, back to the phones. Let's see who's been holding. It's Joella. Joella, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fresh figs.
Oh, divine fruit, yes.
I was hoping you would think that.
What about them?
I have got this massive fig grove growing next to my house. And besides the usual drying them or making chutney or fig preserves, I wanted to know what you would do with fresh figs.
You have a whole grove of them?
Somebody planted a fig tree probably about 18 years ago, and it's huge. It's a many, many fig trees now. And they're just about to be ready. You know, we got all this big rain in Texas.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're getting very fat.
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, everything is improved by eating them with fresh figs.
True.
I mean, really, I mean, from anything from just splitting them in half and pouring a tad of honey over them, or just eating them straight or eating them with savories. I mean, even shrimp are great with fresh figs. There is something that's done with them, and it's a preserving method in the Puglia region of Italy. It's the heel of the boot.
Okay.
What people do there, and they grow like weeds there, is they split the fig. They sprinkle it with ground anise seed, which they grind in like a mortar and pestle. And they spread them on screens and they put them in the sun. And they essentially, they don't get them absolutely dry as leather, but they get them somewhat dry. They sprinkle them with lemon juice. And then they close the two halves around a toasted almond.
Oh, my goodness.
And then they sort of pack them into a baking pan, and then they put bay leaf here and there and clove here and there, and they bake them in a low oven, like at, you know, 275 degrees. And then you bring those out, and you can have them at room temperature, and you could put ice cream on them or mascarpone or just eat them that way, and you give them as gifts to friends. The only thing about it is, quite frankly, I wouldn't try to keep them a really long, long time because I'm always worried about, you know, mold and that kind of thing. But boy, they are fabulous. Another way of preserving fresh figs is to make an alcohol compote. Now, the alcohol will preserve them. You know, get inexpensive brandy, split a couple of vanilla beans, maybe add a little bit of sugar and just split those figs or put the whole ones into jars and pour that mixture in and let them just macerate. Isn't that a great word?
Yes.
And let them go for at least 3 weeks, but they'll keep for a year. And they look so pretty. So you can find old canning jars. You know, you can do them in any kind of container you want. Just always keep them covered with the alcohol.
Okay.
Does that?
Both of those things are along the lines of what I hoped you would tell me. Nothing just run-of-the-mill normal.
I don't know about run-of-the-mill normal.
Yes, it's perfect. I wanted something exotic that I would have never thought of on my own, and this is great.
Do you know the other thing I think I'd throw into that alcohol? Because you're in San Antonio, and you have the best chilies in the world. I do the split vanilla beans and a bit of sugar, and I would split some dried arbol chilies.
Readily available.
You got it. And wouldn't that chili, that spike of chili with the richness of the fig and all those other flavors be wonderful?
Yes.
Okay.
I intend to try both of your suggestions along with serving fresh figs with everything.
Okay, and I know now the Christmas present that most of your friends are going to get.
Okay, don't tell anyone.
I won't, Joella. Thank you.
Thanks.
Goodbye. If you're lucky enough to get your hands on fresh figs, there's one other thing I didn't mention to her, but it's so good. Brush them with olive oil, sprinkle them with a little black pepper, and throw them on the hottest grill you can get, especially if you've got a wood fire. And just sear fig halves on one side, put them on a plate, and just daub a little bit of soft whipped cream on it. And, oh, that is good. Hot fig, cold cream, little spice. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Patty on the line. So, Patty, what's happening? What do you want to talk about?
I was fascinated about ice cream. I adore eating ice cream and also gelato, and wanted to know, what is the ingredient? What makes it different from ice cream?
That's a great question. That's a great question, because it's always a surprise to people when they hear this. Gelato is not as rich as, for instance, our premium ice creams are.
I could have eaten a lot more in Italy than I thought.
Yes. You know, I didn't. You know what? I have never put those two pieces of information together before. A light bulb has just gone off.
Okay.
Generally speaking, gelatos are made with whole milk, as opposed to a lot of cream. Now, I say generally speaking because there are always exceptions to this.
Okay.
And often they don't have eggs in them. But there's a couple of keys, though, here. First of all, really intense flavors, which you probably remember from Italy.
Yes.
And then the most important thing about a gelato, assuming you've got high-quality ingredients, and it's the point missed by most American gelato manufacturers, the temperature at which it is served. As you remember, in Italy, it's always in these rectangular metal, like, boxes,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And it's scooped with a paddle, and layers of it, like leaves of it, are layered on these little cones, and it's almost melting because it's kept at between 15 and 20 degrees. So you have a lighter mixture. There's a fair amount of air whipped into it, which lightens it even more. It's extremely creamy. It never has ice crystals in it, and it is never frozen solid. And it's that temperature with that wonderful creaminess that it produces that gives us the perception of the gelato.
Aha.
So,
fascinating.
Yeah, so it's really this real careful temperature control. And that's the great key to it. So,
wonderful.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are people out there who have good recipes. I mean, there are two writers. Now, that I want to think. Michelle Ciccolone.
Okay.
I think has done some good gelato recipes in her book. She's done several books, like on Italian desserts and stuff. And then there's Nick Malgeri, who writes about desserts and baking. He's an expert, and I know he's got some gelato recipes. But remember the key. It's the temperature. So when I see these frozen blocks, you know, in the freezer at the supermarket, it's like, guys, you missed the point.
Yes, that's interesting. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
And thank you for, yes, now I'm on to eating a lot more.
Yeah, just think low fat, essentially.
Exactly.
Low
exactly.
fat.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
It's the thing that a lot of people don't realize, that the temperature of something, a frozen dessert of any kind, it makes all the difference in perception. And if I'm going to be really picky, let me tell you one other thing that I think is really missed by some top restaurants. You know, very fancy restaurants make their own ice cream and their own sorbets, and they charge us a lot of money. Well, I'll tell you what, one of the things that makes a great ice cream or sorbet, and that is it should hit your palate and melt like silk. No graininess, no ice. And what really fine restaurants do in France, between lunch and dinner, they melt down the ice cream, they melt down the sorbet, and they remix it in the ice cream maker. So it's utterly silken, and there's no ice crystals. So if you're going to be really picky, I would send it back. I mean, at $10 a serving, if it's not perfect, you send it back. The number is 800-537-5252. I have got a great source for everybody who's thinking about going to Europe or anywhere in the world and taking cooking classes. There is a book, it's a paperback, and it's called Cooking in Paradise, Culinary Vacations Around the World by Joel and Lee Naftali. And what I like about this book is they seem to have visited every school they write about. They talk about what the class is like, and they talk about how to contact the people. So it's called Cooking in Paradise, and the information's on the website. Well, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up? We've got Rick calling. So, Rick, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Elaine. It's really nice talking to you. It's a pleasure. And I have a question about table manners.
Oh, okay.
I love olives, especially Kalamata olives.
Uh-huh.
And how to get the pits out of my mouth is a big problem all the time. You don't want to grab it with your hand. You try to put it on the fork and falls out of the fork. And what is the best way to do it so that it looks nice?
And it's really rude to spit it across the table trying to get it into the olive dish. Yeah, I know. It's really hard. You know, now that you say this, I'm trying to think. First of all, I'm very amused, Rick, that you think I might have knowledge of etiquette. But at any rate, there's an old thing about whether it's a cherry pit or an olive pit or something that's stuck in your teeth, and I think it would apply to olive pits. You hold a napkin up over your mouth with one hand, and you very gracefully kind of dispose of the olive into the other hand, and you drop it on your plate, and you leave it there, or wherever you think you can put it gracefully. I have been in situations where I've been so uncomfortable and there haven't been any napkins handy that I've just sort of tucked them in my cheek, and boy, does that get you into trouble.
No, I love to eat a lot of them.
I know what you mean. Yeah, but if you, that's really the way you usually handle these kinds of things that involve a pit. Uh-huh. That you hold that napkin over your mouth very discreetly and with the other hand behind the napkin.
Well, I've been doing it wrong all this time, trying to put it on my fork slowly from my mouth.
But I think that's such an elegant thing to try to do. I think it requires...
Well, I'm not successful all the time. Sometimes it falls off. And it's really embarrassing. But thanks for that.
Well, there is one other option, depending on who you're with, of course. You could have a spinning contest. Who can flip their olive the farthest across the room, especially outdoors? Why not?
Outdoors, yeah. But indoors, I'm the guy who's doing the cleaning.
Oh, no. You don't want that then. And you have to have a pretty loose group to pull that off. Hey, Rick, thank you for a question that probably has plagued quite a few listeners.
Thanks for your tip.
Goodbye. Okay, chili lovers, listen up. You got chili in just about every kind of food, and now there is chili soda, or pop, depending on where you live in the country. It's the creation of a New York City chef named Ron Chrisman, and he calls it Loco Soda. So, Ron, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Thank you very much.
So, Ron, do you just sit around dreaming up new soft drinks?
Well, it's more like I get an idea that comes to me in a very almost violent way, and I can't get it out of my mind until I try it.
So chili in soda.
Well, I'm a chef, and there are very few sodas that I like.
Uh-huh.
And I had been struck down by this chili pepper soda pop lemonade idea, and rather than spending money on the available goods, my partner and I agreed that we should go try this chili soda out, and we bought fresh lemons and limes and jalapenos and habaneros and went home and started playing around on the stovetop, and we were drinking it that evening, and it was very good.
So what flavors have you got then?
Well, right now we have lime, mango, blackberry, and raspberry.
And are you using jalapenos and the habaneros, or are you using other kinds of chilies as well?
Well, the chili mix that we use is habanero, jalapeno, and serrano. So they all have that. But Loco Soda is very interesting in that it's the only soda in the world that is made with fresh juice or fresh ingredients.
Well, you know, I've got a bottle of the mango soda here. I want to just see how hot it is.
Have you tried it?
Well, I'm just going to do it right now.
Good.
Oh, boy, it's got what I think of as the nose factor.
Yes.
I can get the chili. Oh, that tastes really fresh. And it's not super hot. I mean, it's nice, but it's not super hot.
Well, when Catherine and I made the first batch, it was five times hotter than it is now.
Seared its way down the tongue, right?
Yes.
Do you have a hard time selling chili soda to people?
Well, we are up against some very large companies, as you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
And those large companies have massive budgets for advertising and marketing. Plus the fact that nobody's ever heard of a soda pop with chili pepper in it. We have two hurdles to climb. But the one thing that we do have is that when people try it, they become loyal fans, and we get emails from them all the time, and they buy it through the mail.
So people can mail order it?
Yes.
Oh, this is great. Hey, Ron, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ron Crimson is creator of Loco Soda. To get more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought. Men are from Earth. Women are from Earth. Deal with it. You can find all the information you will ever need on our website, splendidtable.org. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, drop us a line at the Splendid Table Forum and take a look at the Splendid Table store. All the proceeds go to support the show. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.